Hi, this is John DeLynn. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. What you're about to hear is part of an all-day workshop recorded at the Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium on August 4th, 2010. The first half of the day was dedicated to navigating an LDS faith crisis in or out of the LDS Church. And the second half of the day was dedicated to navigating an LDS marriage when one of you loses their faith. Since I'm in graduate school, I put this workshop on in part to help raise money for my family's health insurance. So my initial intent was to only share this workshop with those of you who contributed financially to the podcast. However, many of you, my financial supporters, have encouraged me to go ahead and release the full workshop anyway so that all can benefit. So that's what I've decided to do. But I'm doing it with a plea. If you have not contributed to Mormon Stories and you find value in this workshop, please take a moment to contribute to Mormon Stories today at mormonstories.org, either with a one-time donation or signing up for a monthly subscription. Without this support, I cannot continue to create this content for others and for you. So thanks so much to all of you who are monthly subscribers, and please keep in touch through email at mormonstories@gmail.com. And now, on to the workshop. I hope you enjoy. Hello, my name is John DeLynn. I'm very happy to have you here today, and I'm honored and privileged and humbled to be able to talk to you a little bit and to be able to talk with you with some very special guests that I've actually brought to help in this dialogue. Natasha Parker was kind enough to come all the way from Wichita, Kansas. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, and she was featured on a recent Mormon Stories episode that I've gotten some really good feedback about. She has a blog called mormontherapist.blogspot.com, and I'm working on it, working with her on having her own domain name. She ends up providing therapy to a lot of LDS people. Probably what? You said 80% of your clients? 90%. Yeah. So she's got a fantastic blog and has great insight. So I invited her to come help with this presentation, and she said she would, and I'm just thrilled. So I want to introduce Natasha. I've also invited two very dear friends of mine to be a part of this discussion, Laurie and Dan Gallagher. They live in the Bay Area, South Bay? What is it, East Bay? What do you call it? East Bay. They've also been featured on a podcast on Mormon Stories, where they talked about navigating a mixed faith marriage where one believes and one doesn't. And I think that they have a lot of insight to provide as well. I think they're both very wise and thoughtful and good people. So thank you so much, Dan and Laurie, for coming as well. And we just got done with a 3-hour marathon of talking about navigating a crisis of faith within Mormonism. My voice is already starting to go, and I'm tired, and I can't imagine. I don't want to hear myself talk, so I can't imagine any of you wanting to hear me talk anymore. But maybe I'll give a little bit of an introduction, some ground rules, and then we'll kind of try and keep this as collaborative as possible. But thank you again for coming. A few ground rules. I want everybody to feel very safe here, that there won't be any judgments on any opinion or feeling you want to express or talk about. There's no dumb question. There's no biases about are you liberal enough or are you conservative enough or are you a believer enough or, you know, are you not believing enough. We don't want to have any of that kind of judgment here. This is just attempting to be a very practical workshop for people who are in need of learning or maybe discussing or brainstorming or getting a few tools to help them navigate a marriage when there's a crisis of faith. So I hope we'll all help together to nurture that safe environment. I want this to be very participatory. As I mentioned earlier, I don't want to just stand here and talk like I really know anything or make you guys feel like I've got all the answers. The longer I live, the less I feel like I know. But since I've had the benefit of speaking with hundreds of couples who are struggling in a mixed faith kind of marriage, I do feel like I've got some experience on their behalf that I can share and that we can at least discuss. So I hope this will be very participatory. If all we did was have you guys ask questions and then we facilitated a discussion between us and you, I'd be delighted. I do have a few things just to kind of set up a few thoughts, but other than that, I'm pretty happy with just free form, actually, if you are. I want to make sure you understand that we're taking a destination agnostic approach, and what I mean by that is I'm not here to tell you to stay in the church. I'm not here to tell you to leave the church. I'm not here to tell you to stay in your marriage. I'm not here to tell you to leave your marriage. That's it's above my pay grade. And so with that, you may, if those of you who consider yourself true believers may be uncomfortable when we're talking about the prospects of not staying in the church. And those of you who are committed to your marriage may not like talks about how to constructively end a marriage, and vice versa. Those of you who hate the church might feel frustrated when we're talking about constructive ways to make it work, or those who can't stand their spouse and want to get divorced may not like talking about how to make it maybe work. But we're not, you know, we just want to make sure you understand that, and that we're also not going to be dealing with truth claims here. The purpose of this is not to convince you the church is false and not to convince you the church is true. We're not even going to touch any of that. So don't feel like we're swaying in any way. Or want this to be very supportive and practical. And I would like to just get a quick sense. Let me see. Okay, brief intro for those of you who was not here in the morning. Raise your hand. Wow. Okay. So I'll just give you a brief intro. My name's John DeLynn. I had a big crisis of faith about 10 or so years ago, where I was called as a seminary teacher in Seattle when I worked for Microsoft to teach students. I was born in the church, pioneer ancestry, served a mission, seminary president. Just the church was everything to me. Loved my mission. Had a hard mission, but loved it. And got married in the temple and, you know, was committed to Mormonism in every way. And as through studying church history for my seminary calling and through just some relationships with some good friends, I stumbled upon sort of the real story in terms of what our history is really about. And I wasn't prepared for it. I was shocked and sickened by a lot of the stuff that I read, all coming from church materials, none of it coming from anti-Mormon sources, but just books published by the church, journals and diaries and church publications were my pretty much only sources. And it just happened somehow that kind of the more factual history had never really been taught to me by the time I was 30 or 35. So I felt lied to and deceived and frustrated and sad and scared, because my wife and I were active in the church and my wife enjoyed her membership. She was active in Young Women's at the time. You know, we had three children. All my immediate family is active and committed to the church. And it's a really terrifying place to be, where you start not being able to believe things like you did and trying to figure out what to do with that. And so I struggled for a long time, kind of. I got to this really dark and bitter place where I would always try and find people at church or colleagues that I could talk to and maybe argue with to try and get some answers, or at least find other people who understood or could relate to the things that I was thinking and feeling. Found very few people who I could talk to. Slowly I started trying to figure out if I could talk to my wife, but you know, I was in such an angry place that I'm sure that often she didn't want to talk, or she just didn't feel like that was something she really was interested in pursuing. She's always been very happy with her membership. It was good for her family. It was good for our family. And so she saw me reading more and more books and getting darker and darker and darker. And one day I just pulled her aside and turned to her and said, "Honey, I'm not sure that the church is what it claims to be, and I'm not sure the church is what I thought it was." And immediately just the tears just welled up in her eyes and came right down her face. And that was a really hard moment for our family. And 10 years later, we've been trying to find our way ever since. We've remained married, and we've come to a really comfortable place, my wife and I. Very comfortable. I have no problems at all with the church as it relates to my wife, and we are right now active in the church. But we're very unorthodox in belief and somewhat unorthodox in some of our behaviors, though none of the ones you'd think. It's not, I've never been interested in Word of Wisdom stuff or Law of Chastity stuff or any of the stuff that some people become interested in. My unorthodoxy is just around other types of things. We can talk about that if you want, but that's a brief intro. I guess the only other thing I'll say is I started this podcast called Mormon Stories. It's had several thousand listeners to date, and I guess because of that podcast, I get calls and emails every week, 2 to 3 couples showing up on my doorstep or asking me to go to lunch, and the story's pretty much always identical. It's usually the husband that stumbles upon the history, starts to question, decides that the church isn't true, but the wife loves the church and is still a believer. And Dan and Lori are somewhat of an inverse of that. But that's the typical story. One believes, one doesn't. And they're trying to decide, do we dissolve the marriage? Does the believer just take the kids and divorce the disbeliever? How do we navigate this? And even if we're committed to our marriage, how do we make it work when one thinks the church might be damaging to the children, but the other feels like the church is going to be wonderful for the children? How do we navigate a marriage when the fundamentals of what brought us together are now no longer a sound foundation that we mutually share? And I've counseled over 1,000 people in this type of situation, and that's kind of where I am. So for those who are comfortable sharing, how many couples are here together? Raise your hand if you're here with your partner. Okay. And how many of your situations mirror, how many of your situations have where one of you is sort of a traditional believer and one of you is not? Okay. All right. Okay. So this is really tricky because like the stuff you would have maybe heard in the first 3 hours might be really disturbing, because like when you're really, as I was, just sort of living the normal Orthodox LDS life, there's just a lot of stuff you don't hear, there's a lot of stuff you don't know about, there's a lot of stuff you don't think about. You pretty much are with the program, and it works, and why mess with it? And the problem with getting people of across the faith spectrum together is that some people are going to say things that are disturbing to a believer. They're going to mention historical things that are disturbing. Sometimes they'll even speak of the church in an unflattering way because they're feeling things and having a bad experience. And that's just always going to be disturbing to someone who still considers themselves a believer. So I want you to know that I'm sensitive to that. I'm not insensitive to that at all. And I want to do my best to encourage everyone to talk about religion as if you would talk to a colleague at work about their religion, with respect and humility, instead of in a way that's disparaging or demeaning or critical in a way that's not constructive. So I hope you guys will work with me to create as much of a safe environment as we can. And I hope that what we offer is helpful to both parties. So with that, I guess I wanted to just set the tone for what I think are a few of the most important themes, and hopefully most of this will be discussion. But the way that I wanted to set up was just to talk about perspectives. And this I think is one of the most important issues that we'll probably discuss today. Imagine a young man from Boston who's a police officer, and It turns out that his dad was a police officer. His dad always taught him to be honest, to be law-abiding, that there's an important role for the policeman in society to maintain order, to keep the peace, to help arbitrate disputes, and to keep people safe. And let's say that that father was killed in the line of duty. The son was a young boy when he saw his father give his life for this profession. He decided to become a policeman too. And he is just a proud member of the Boston Police Force. Can you guys kind of get into that perspective and see how someone could love the career and the profession of being a policeman? Think about 9/11 and what the firefighters and the policemen did to help those who were dying or suffering, to help alleviate their pain and to save them from pain or injury. You can see how someone could get the perspective that police work is a fantastic and a beautiful and a wonderful thing. And maybe we could all get in that mindset of feeling okay about that perspective. Are we all there? All right. Well, imagine someone like Rodney King, who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and there were some riots going on, and there were some policemen who were very scared and trying to make good on a really hard situation, and by being in the wrong place at the wrong time, was on the receiving end of some serious brutality by a policeman. And maybe his father, you know, and let's say that his father had experienced abuse, maybe being racially profiled or in some other way, treated unfairly by the police force. And you could see how he's going to have a very different perspective on what it's like to be a policeman and how he feels about a policeman. Does that make sense? And you can kind of go between these two perspectives and kind of see that both are totally legitimate, that neither are wrong, and in some ways both are right, and in maybe some cases both might be wrong in some ways, but I guess through experience you can sort of get to a place where you can see that two people can have very opposing perspectives, but at the same time both come at that from an honest and a place of integrity and good reason. And, you know, another person that, you know, I can think of, or another contrast is my stepfather. He's a beautiful, wonderful man who grew up in a rural town in Idaho. His parents were, let's just say, not very nurturing or supportive. He was raised mostly by extended family. He was gored by a bull at a young age. He lived in circumstances that most of us would consider to be worse than third world circumstances. And just by some stroke of luck, he was fortunate enough to join in the military right, you know, around the time of World War II. He was trained as a pilot. He helped you know, defeat Nazi Germany in World War II. He was able to help defeat the oppressors of the French and others, and see how through the use of proper use of military force, a people could be freed and oppressors could be beat back. And he went on to serve in Vietnam and trained other pilots. And this is one of the most beautiful, wonderful, spiritual, righteous, humble, gentle, good men who's committed and loyal and faithful to his family that I've ever met. And he loves the military. He is true blue, red, white, and blue. Loves this country, loves our military, and pretty much feels like they can do no wrong. And I can understand that perspective. And here's a young mother from Afghanistan who was herself the victim of rape and whose children were in an unfortunate place at the wrong time and were blown apart by a bomb as collateral damage. And you can understand that he's going to have a perspective where he thinks the U.S. military is wonderful and fantastic, and she's going to see it as the most horrible thing on the planet because it took her children away from her, and it's led her to all sorts of grief and trauma. And it's hard to say whether one's right or one's wrong. You could probably try and tease that apart, but if I had to get to one central theme that I think is going to give all of us the best chance of navigating a marriage when one has a crisis of faith, is to remember this notion of perspective. For those of you who are disbelievers, Chances are you were once a believer just like your spouse. And you felt a lot of the same things that your spouse feels now. And maybe other people who were disbelievers earlier would come to you and you would have all sorts of good reasons why they were silly and you didn't want to listen to them and you were uncomfortable for the things that they were saying. But because you had that believing perspective at the time. And now those tables have been turned and maybe you're the disbeliever and your spouse remains a believer. And you're trying to figure out how to navigate that. And maybe you're tempted to be a little bit insensitive or critical or judgmental of the believer because you now see belief as foolish or naive or something of that nature. And your spouse may very well be very happy and content and maybe even very well informed in their belief. And doing the flip side, maybe you're the believer and you're struggling to understand why your spouse is in this dark place that doesn't seem constructive, doesn't seem helpful, that seems damaging, that seems like it's going to derail your family, that the agreements and the contract upon which your marriage was founded now has been violated. And you're trying to understand whether a bait and switch occurred, whether this person was honest with you or whether they've committed some egregious sin or some type of other violation that would cause them to be walking down the path that they're walking. And it's easy to judge them as well. And I would just say that's sort of something that I would love to try and help build that muscle, the muscle for empathy for varying perspectives. Because as we're going to get into this today, I think that the believing perspective is legitimate, and I think the disbelieving perspective is legitimate. I think both are very legitimate. And I know smart, intelligent, informed, sensitive people who are on both sides of that equation. And I know many people who are disbelievers who have done everything they could possibly do to be believers, and they just have not been able to do it. And so I think that I hope that we can talk about that today. And if we can build up anything, it's a sense of a place, a space within you of empathy and tolerance and support for that alternate perspective that isn't yours. And so as you think about the traditional Mormon marriage and how it usually works, you know, you get in the marriage with sort of ideal of what's going to happen. Maybe you're both returned missionaries, you get married in the temple, you're going to have four kids or maybe six, you're going to raise them righteously in the church, you're both going to stay active, you're going to have lots of grandkids and celebrate this wonderful life of commitment to the church. Maybe you'll serve a mission when you're in old age. You know, that's sort of how many marriages within the church start. And, you know, we really think we know and we understand each other. And you kind of have a contract of what your marriage is going to be like, and you have an understanding. But it turns out that contract isn't just between two people. Oftentimes that contract is between you, your spouse, and the church. And this is something that's really hard to tease apart, because sometimes it's hard to know whether someone's married their spouse or they've married the church, and the spouse was just sort of part of that contractual agreement. They're the ones that fill that slot for the ideal life that you planned on having someday, and they become more of a functional utility player in this grand scheme of Mormon life that you had envisioned for yourself. And sometimes it's really hard to tease apart the church from how much of your marriage really was just you two sincerely knowing each other and loving each other versus you being in the plan and this person dropping in the right slot for you to continue with the plan that was designed for you and that you chose to follow yourself. And then something terrible and unexpected happens, and one of you has a crisis of faith, something that is rarely planned and can cause all sorts of disruption. And then that person changes, and they're all of a sudden questioning all sorts of things. Maybe they want to start drinking alcohol. Maybe they want to stop going to church. Maybe they want to teach the kids things that are not things that the church has taught. Maybe they want to experiment with other types of options. You know, there are all sorts of ways that people end up wanting to break the agreement or to change the terms of that relationship. And I guess as we try and understand the perspectives of both parties, I'll just reiterate what I've already said. I've never met a disbeliever who, like, would have chosen that when they were in their best moments as a happy believing Mormon. These people, the cost of expressing disbelief within the LDS Church is extremely high. The potential painful and damaging consequences of expressing disbelief within the church are real, and they're dramatic. I can't tell you how many people email me and say, my wife has taken the kids and left me because I've read the wrong book, and now I'm questioning things, and now I've lost my children. It's almost to me, I think of a lot. I think, as we talked earlier today, I think of the situation of someone being gay or homosexual is very much similar to what it's like to become a disbeliever in the church. I've interviewed dozens of gay people, had several close friends, and pretty much all of them say that for many, many years, they would have given anything to change this about themselves. They did do everything. They prayed, they fasted, they went on missions, they lived every single commandment that the church gave them with exact obedience. And some of them have gone 10, 20 years still waiting for that day when the Lord would take this feeling that they had away from them, having never experimented with sexuality oftentimes at all, ever in their lives, doing everything they can to make it go away, and they couldn't. And I think that there's a lot of similarities there. Once someone's crossed that threshold of disbelief, it's often with having made many efforts to try and fix it. The other thing I want to say is that disbelief within the LDS Church is happening at a very significant rate and at an increasingly significant rate. I would say thousands to tens of thousands, if not more, of people are leaving the church every year. And if you actually look at activity rates that are sort of pieced together through statistical analysis, you'll find that about two-thirds of the members of the church are inactive from the church. In many of the countries, like in South America, the disparity between what the church claims the number of members are and what the actual censuses show, there's a dramatic disparity between people who call themselves Mormon and people who the church keeps on the rolls. And I can tell you that, on average, two-thirds of the member of any ward are inactive from the church, and one-third are active. Now, in Utah, because of some of the social dynamics, it's going to be a little bit less. Then if you go to Latin America and the third world, you're going to find 10 to 20% activity rates in many of those countries. But I guess the thing I want to say is disbelief is the norm within the church, not the exception. I hate to say this, but rarely have I found someone who crossed that threshold of disbelief who is able to put themselves back in the box of literalistic Orthodox belief. It has happened, but it's extremely rare. But the most common situation is once they no longer believe the church is literally the one and only true church with exclusive authority, and they find out all the historical stuff and they find out all the cultural stuff, they'll never have that Orthodox traditional testimony again, more often than not. Now, there are ways to reconstitute your testimony into something that's more symbolic and metaphoric and nuanced. And there are people who are willing to maintain activity in spite of disbelief, just as a service to their spouse. But that's been my experience, and if you guys have had other experiences, I'm very interested in hearing about that too. These people, by and large, that I've communicated with who have lost their faith in the church, did not leave the church because they were offended. They did not leave the church because they wanted to sin. They did not leave the church because there was some commandment they couldn't keep or they were weak. These are usually the people who were zone leaders and assistants to the president on their missions. These are usually the people who are pioneer, multi-generational pioneer stock. And if you think about what would lead someone to be willing to even consider that the church isn't what it claims to be, you have to realize that in many cases this requires a high degree of caring, because why would you study to the depths that you need to study if you didn't care? So these people, by and large, care more than the average, love the church more than average. I was the seminary teacher, loving my experience with my students when I was thrust into this sort of situation. So they care, and they are honest. These are people who are willing to say that, do what is right, let the consequences follow. And I may lose my spouse, I may lose my children, I may lose my job, I may lose the respect and admiration of my parents and siblings and extended family, but I have to be true to what I feel. And so I'm going to share my true feelings, even if it's going to cost me everything. And so it's easy to demonize these people as having committed some sin or being weak. That's just not been my experience. I'd say 90%+ of the people that I've spoken to are of the highest integrity, highest degree of morality, and authenticity. And we'll talk about some of these other things later. I'm going to jump through this and come back to it. About the believer, for those of you who are disbelievers, it's understand that you remember that you were once in their shoes. And there was a time when someone probably could never have shaken you from your belief. And so there are all sorts of things you need to try your best to remember as you're working through your own pain and anger and frustration. One is that you're the one who switched the deal, not them. You were married under a certain set of circumstances and rules, and now you've changed the game. Now, in marriages, you're allowed to change. You're allowed to grow. That's a good thing. But at the same time, when you decide to reorient yourself so fundamentally away from the terms upon which your marriage was based, I think that warrants a certain sense of, maybe a very high sense of sensitivity and compassion and empathy for the person who remains a believer. It certainly doesn't warrant your mocking or your ridicule or your scorn for their disbelief. The belittlement of saying, well, you're just weak-minded. You just don't have the courage to find out the truth. You're just sticking your head in the sand like an ostrich. That's not a very affirming, compassionate way to deal with someone who's in the same shoes you were just up until recently. You have to realize that these people are terrified of change. So often it's the woman who remains the believer. And more often than not, the woman doesn't care about church history. In my experience, that's a generalization, but it's my anecdotal experience. My wife was very similar. She was willing to read a couple books, but from her perspective, it was as simple as, this church works for me. I don't care what happened 150 years ago. This is a great place to raise my children. I'm happy here. I've got a lot of friends. And that's the level upon which they're engaging. And they don't oftentimes care about, you know, Fanny Alger or any of that stuff. And so for them to just sort of consider changing fundamentally their worldview is very disturbing. It's very terrifying. It requires a complete reassembly of your entire worldview, how you view the afterlife, how you view death, how you deal with the deaths of close, beloved family members, how you might be coping with some type of mental illness or something you're struggling with. It's terrifying, and it's something to be dealt with compassion, not with scorn and mocking and ridicule. It's very common for the believer to say, once we start throwing things out, once we start changing, where does it end? Are we going to throw everything out? Am I going to have anything left for my children, for our family, for us? Are you going to want an open marriage? Are you going to tell me that you want, you know, to mess around? Are you going to tell me that we're going to just give our kids nothing to believe in and nothing to hold to? And so it's very unsettling and destabilizing. And most importantly, I'm often fall victim of this, of just assuming that the disbeliever is more informed and the believer is uninformed. And that's not always true. There are lots of believers who are much more informed than any disbelievers out there. And so belief is not a stupid thing, and it's just unkind and inaccurate to equate belief with ignorance or stupidity or anything negative. But I will stick to the belief that no church or no religion is important enough or powerful enough or should be powerful enough to break up a healthy marriage and to break up a healthy family. And that's exactly why I'm doing this workshop and why I'm here. Sometimes divorce is a great thing. Sometimes it's a horrible thing. Sometimes it's what you need to heal and to become healthy. Sometimes it'll destroy everyone's life for a generation. But regardless of all that, I don't believe that the churches or religion should be put in front of close, intimate family relationships. There has to be a way for family relationships to transcend the church and orthodoxy and literalistic, dogmatic, or non-dogmatic beliefs. And so I guess I have a bunch of recommendations and suggestions that I think might be helpful as sort of tools in your toolbox for coming to grips and dealing with this perspective. But before we jump into that, I would like to just throw the floor up for questions and just see, I'd like to hear, like, if you had on top of your mind some of the things you most want to get to, we can just deal with them up front, and there may be some slides I can jump to deal with them, or it may be that just between the panel and our own communication, we're able to really help each other come up with some tools to support. I'm going to give a couple ground rules, okay? I said this in the past session. Everyone needs to talk into the microphone. This mic will not broadcast anything you say. There are no speakers in this room. Since we're recording this for the benefit of other people, it's important that not my voice only be on the recording, that everyone else, you know, they're talking and their questions are kind of like that. So I'm going to ask everyone who ever makes a comment for the rest of these 3 hours or whatever it is to speak into the microphone and wait until the microphone is handed to you, if that's okay. Secondly, I'm going to ask you to really try and be sensitive to the fact that we have a lot of people here. Lots of people are going to want to ask questions and share their perspective. And people have come with all sorts of needs. And so for those of you who decide to contribute, and I hope all of you will contribute, please keep your comments brief and on target. Please be aware of how much you've been talking. And if you find that it's been a minute or two and you're still going, try and just kind of realize that you need to cut it short and be sensitive to the fact that people have come to hear a broad set of perspectives. And if you found that you've already asked a question or two or made a comment or two, please just sort of then kind of fade back a bit and let others step up so that we can have a nice collaborative experience that no one person sort of dominated. I apologize that I have to say that, but other than that, I'm going to be shuttling this microphone between our panelists. I'm going to just say that for those of you who consider yourself, for those of you who would like to speak to someone who sort of is in the believer camp and considers themselves in the believer camp, that's sort of the camp that Dan's representing, although it's never fair to sum anybody up with that type of stereotype. Dan has his own set of sophisticated and nuanced beliefs. He's in no way a dogmatic, orthodox, you know, traditional type Mormon. But at the same time, he represents the believer half in his family. And more importantly, when he and Lori went through their crisis, he definitely represented that believer side. And that may be a value to direct your questions either as the disbeliever or the believer or somewhere in the middle. Lori represents sort of the out-of-her-closet, open disbeliever. Is that okay? She's going to have a better way to describe it, but that's how I'm going to introduce Lori. And then Natasha kind of balances that middle as someone who has counseled people in this situation and has a lot of experience there. So with that, I'm going to start by just saying who's got topics they want to talk about, and we'll go from there.
I just would like to see a show of hands in here, because I know right now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 4 were the women, were the ones that were disbelievers first. And so I'm wondering if this crowd actually matches what your experience has been, where it's the man first. That's all. I was just curious if we're willing to do that.
Okay, so for the couples where it's the male who was first a disbeliever, raise your hand. And for the couples where it was the female who was first a disbeliever, raise your hand. Okay, that's actually... Yeah, so my anecdotal experience isn't always accurate. I'm fine with that. I have no problem with that. Okay, good. That was great. Okay, we have a question here.
So when you described your typical situation, you pretty much nailed mine. And so I'd like to see discussed, particularly what to do about the kids. So I've got 6 kids, the oldest is 10, and we talked a little bit last session about, you know, when to introduce some of these concepts that, you know, daddy may think one thing and mommy may think another, and how to go about that. And then what do you do about, you know, your boys when they are approaching mission age and the cultural and familial pressures, how to inoculate children when they begin the young men and young women program in seminary. And I'm using that term not as an offensive sort of way, but from maybe my perspective. And just basically, what do you do with the kids when we both have, you know, I change the game and, you know, she's great and our marriage relationship is actually fantastic, but, you know, where does this lead us, particularly with children?
That's great. So. I have a lot of experience in inoculating children, to use the term, in helping to, as an unorthodox believer, raise my kids in a way to where I could feel comfortable with them being in the church, but still having some of the values that I cherish.
And that's what I
don't have experience with is navigating the conflict of deciding how to approach that, because my wife and I were always in unison on that point. So let's start with that first question that I don't have experience with. Do either of you want to try and talk about how you... Do you guys mind if Dan and Lori talk a little bit about this? Okay.
For your question, I think there doesn't have to be as much disagreement there as it might seem, because what we found with us is that we don't really disagree on values. And I think what happens is that the people that are kind of in disagreement about the church think they're in disagreement about values, and it doesn't have to be that way. Because so many of the Mormon customs and lifestyle things, this is my own view, maybe this is my heretical view, but I don't see them as values. They're kind of means to an end. They're expression of values. You know, if you're talking about something like the Word of Wisdom, you know, Lori values physical health probably more than I do. She teaches yoga for a living. So it'd be laughable for me to say, well, if I had a different view on the Word of Wisdom and she didn't, that we disagree on that value, we don't. So I think you need to put it in the understanding that you probably agree on more values than you think. So it's more a matter of navigating maybe some of the social issues. To your point on missions, and I'll hand it to Lori. My particular view, I have 2 sons, and the oldest is 15. So we're a few years from this. But my own mission experience, I spent most of my mission actually undoing the damage done by guys who didn't want to be there. So even at our most believing time in our marriage, when Lori was actually a stronger believer than I was, it was never going to be the case that my kids go, because that's what you do. My view has always been, if they want to go, they're going to go, but they're not going to be raised with the thought that you have to do this because this is what everybody does. So that's pretty much the similar approach. If they get to that age and they feel that pull, that drive, I think we're together in saying that's fine. That's up to them, but they're not getting a different message from us, like from me saying, okay, you have to go, from her saying, please don't, or, you know, we're more in agreement on that than maybe some are. But do you want to add?
I guess the question is your wife nervous about you, about them learning other ways than Mormonism? She really wants them in?
I mean, you're right. We agree on the values approach. And right now, you know, I'm as active as I've ever been. And I was very active and very committed. But, you know, I don't know how to introduce this concept to the kids. And I think my wife is afraid that it'll, you know, basically destroy their faith before they ever have a chance to develop faith.
We've had interesting experiences with that because I think it's really hard when it comes to the point of they don't want, if the believer doesn't want their child introduced, and I want to make a point about that, if the believer doesn't want their child introduced to any other thought process, I have an interesting perspective because I'm the mother. I spend more time teaching the kids. I'm just with them more. And I'm, you know, there comes my mama bear instinct. Like, how dare anybody tell me I can't teach my children what I believe? But I stand up firmly for the fathers, if there are a lot more fathers that have that, that each parent needs to have that space and freedom to teach their kids. It's really important to your relationship with your child. And I believe that when you start tiptoeing around and kind of talking and not knowing how to navigate, they know you're holding back. They know you're not telling the truth. So at every age stage of development, I found, the 5-year-old, the 10-year-old, the 15-year-old, I talk differently to each one, but truthfully. So the 10-year-old is in that black and white phase of thinking. So it's really funny talking to him and kind of shattering his black and white thinking as he's ready as we go along. 15-year-old and I can talk about everything. The 10-year-old the other day said something I'm trying to remember. He said, ask me some question about Joseph Smith. So we're talking about Joseph Smith. We're talking about pioneers. I think it was Pioneer Day or something. And I said, Joseph had lots of wives. And he went, what? You're only supposed to have one wife. And instead of going, yeah, isn't that crazy and weird? Not, I said, yeah, we think you should have one wife and other people don't. And I just left it. I watched his eyes kind of go and I watched it kind of sink in. And I know that that conversation will come up.
Right.
And I know
I've been kind of doing the same thing, but a little worried about how that's going over with my spouse.
You know, I think there's that constant sensitivity and talking with each other.
Yeah. This is great. I want to ask Natasha to talk a little bit about something I read in her notes. But Natasha, you wrote something about kids will eat you alive if you're not on the same page. But being on the same page doesn't mean you agree. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Okay, so I call adolescents especially the hypocrisy police, and this is the number one thing that they get angry about, and they can't believe their parents, and blah, 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 and they're so much smarter than all of us, and I was that way too, so I do believe that what's much more important than coming to an agreement on this is what we're going to teach our children is more what are the basic philosophies and values underneath? And I love that he brought up common values. In fact, this is one of the first exercises I do with couples who are struggling with parenting issues, which if you have kids, you're going to struggle with this. This is normal. Even if you don't have a crisis of faith, we struggle with this kind of stuff. So one of the exercises I give is you write down every single value that you believe you have in common with your spouse. You do this independently of each other. And so I'm kind of giving this as maybe you'll go do this. This is an assignment, I guess. And then you spend a date night or two or three discussing these values. And this list can be a wonderful kind of fluid list that you add to over the years. Maybe you take something away over the years. It doesn't have to be fast, right now. But it's kind of your best assessment of what your common values are. And because this is going to be the basis of what you teach your children. I don't care what religion you're in, okay? And these are the basics that your children are going to get from you. Now, what people in a faith of crisis situation are in is that you're in an opportunity that people who don't have this in their lives don't have. And by that I mean that we like to live in this parental fantasy land that we have full control over our children and whatever we believe they will believe, and we're going to raise them to be wonderful people, and we completely go past their agency, which is so ironic because this is one of our core beliefs as LDS members, for those of us who are believing LDS people. So don't underestimate your children. Just because they see you struggle or stumble is not going to be the base for their struggle and stumble. What is going to be the base of their struggle and stumble is if you lie about your struggle and stumble. That's where the hypocrisy police come in. And so for the example of mission, you can have a very upfront discussion with your adolescent. And your wife may say something like, you know what, honey, I believe that going on a mission is going to be a fabulous experience for you. I want this for you. I think that you will mature, whatever, blah, blah, blah. You'll help people. You know, you'll have an opportunity here that you might not otherwise have. I want you to do this. And you say, these are my concerns about you going on a mission. This is the stuff that worries me. I just want to make sure that you understand these things before you go on a mission. Having that conversation in a place of tolerance, where the parents aren't like rolling their eyes at each other and where the parents aren't diminishing the other, is a much more valuable lesson to your child than what you're actually saying about the mission. Does that make sense?
Good stuff.
And that's the United Front versus the agreement.
Thank you.
This is a question that I had this morning as well, but never really got around to it. My problem with all of this is that there are certain things within the LDS Church that are where there's no wiggle room. Thomas S. Monson is a prophet, and so that's the belief. So when my children go to church and they are taught that, and they come home and I don't believe the same thing, how do you deal with those kinds of things where it's not like just a value that we have? We're talking about a tenet of a testimony that they are supposed to stand up and state as an I know fact. And I don't share that belief. My husband does. How do you deal with those kinds of things that they see as concrete and I do not? I think it would be very difficult to, in fact, it has been very difficult when they come home from church and they, I mean, it's just, it's a statement of fact to them, but it isn't to me. And I don't know how do you express that? I mean, we're on the same page as far as values and as far as how we want to parent our children and the expectation we have for them and the boundaries we have for them. But those very core issues to the church, you know, when the prophet says, it's either true or it's the biggest fraud perpetuated on humanity. I think there's a lot of gray in there. How do you address that with your kids?
Okay. I don't know about all of you, but I don't know of one thing in the church that is an absolute. I can't think of one thing. Even the not murder. Let's not murder people, okay, but Nephi did it and that was okay.
But that's what they're taught when they go to primary. They go to primary and they sing Follow the Prophet and they're just, right. They are not taught that there's any wiggle room in that at all.
I understand that that's what they're not taught necessarily in their churches, but this is where you're in their church lessons. But this is where you have the opportunity as parents, and hopefully if you have this common value approach as a couple, because really where you're going to come into problems as a couple, as a parenting couple, is if you're not okay with the one person saying, hey, these are my concerns about you going on a mission, and the one parent saying, well, these are the reasons I want you to go on a mission. If you're not okay doing that, then that's a couple, that's a marital issue that affects your parenting, and we need to address that first. Because until you come to some kind of an agreement together on that, the kids are going to run over you, because they're going to see that you're not a united front, and they're going to have, there's going to be more room for confusion and for, you know, not understanding what's going on. But if you, for instance, the prophet thing, you know, we're told on the one hand, we're supposed to be doubting and asking and getting our own personal revelation. On the other hand, we're told everything that the prophet says is like it came out of the Lord's mouth. And yet we have things that, you know, Bishop Brigham Young said that when he was a prophet that we no longer believe. I mean, you know, it's not that, it's not, this isn't a black and white church. And whoever thinks it is, you know, we just need to kind of relook at that, because there's lots of conflicting, you know, Adam and Eve, you know, it starts from the very beginning. They're not supposed to do it, but they're supposed to do it. What's black and white about that? It's very gray. So you're right. And so I guess, you know, if you want to say something like, you know, the prophet is a wonderful man, he leads this church, he's doing the best he can, he's trying to get answers for most people that need this kind of help. But you also have a responsibility to think about that. You know, that's a value that you could present as a couple that takes into account both of your belief systems.
And I think I totally agree with that, but I think it becomes really tricky when, especially when the faith crisis is new and the kids are talking about this stuff and you're squirming because you're like, oh, you know, how do I say this without making the other spouse angry and without shaking this little kid up? And it's so nuanced in your life. It's so interwoven. It's not like, And I guess what I've come to discover is that it doesn't have to be big moments of sitting down with them. In fact, those usually backfire. These, sit down and let me teach you, I don't believe this, Dad believes that. But for me, it's become more of becoming really comfortable with what I do and don't believe. And kind of being, I was more quiet during that phase while I was sorting it within. But then, moment to moment throughout the day with the kids, and again, each kid is so different. So the five-year-old was, what, two, three during all of this? So it's been really easy for me to, I mean, the girl prays to Mother in Heaven and knows Shiva and all these big stories from other traditions. Versus, you know, my 10-year-old is very still black and white, and then the teenager can understand metaphor and nuance. So trying to talk with them on their level, little tiny snippets at a time, driving carpool home from high school with the kids that go to seminary together, and they're talking about, I'm asking them, what are you learning, Book of Mormon, Laban, went to get the plates, and I'm like, yeah, I always wondered about how, you know, how'd he get out of there without all that blood all over him? And then I just listen to him go, but I get the conversation rolling. And then we drop off those kids. I don't want to, you know, terrorize them too much. Lean over to my son. I'm like, what do you think? He goes, Mom, it's metaphor. You know, I'm like, yes, he gets it. But little things at a time where they're used to it and giving yourself a break, because you're going to make a lot of mistakes as you navigate that. It can be awkward and... But don't expect, like, big, huge moments of shift. They'll happen, but it'll be more natural than that, I think.
I just wanted to add to that. Many years ago, a wise person told us, the magic is not in the program, the magic is in the child. We need to trust our children more. If we want to do anything to help them to see the inequities or the discrepancies or whatever's not right that we see, all we need to do is persuade them or recognize, acknowledge them as being observant. When they say something, hey, I just noticed, like Lori was saying, agree with them. And when they see what appears to be a conflict in belief or practice in the church, one of the other things that I've learned is that no matter what I do, no matter how bad of a dad I am or how good of a dad I am, as far as my kids are concerned, I'm right. Let me rephrase that. It doesn't matter what my dad has done in his entire life. He is right. I think that's just something that we do as children. And so when those kids see those conflicts, they're going to look to us to find out how are mom and dad handling this conflict. And then it's more of how are we living, and it's more about what do we believe, not what do we not believe, not what are we fighting against. It's more how are we proactively living our life as an example to them. And I think that goes a lot further than, you know, sticking them in the middle and asking them to be the judge in our fight against what we see as wrong with church or the nation or the school or our neighbors or whatever. So.
Now, I can see where you can bridge the gap between the spouses by meeting with common values and then approaching the children in a nuanced way to the extent that they're able to accept it. But I still think, kind of a follow-up on the question below, there will be cases where there will be a fundamental disconnect that can't be bridged. I mean, to take the example, let's say we both agree, this is a hypothetical example, actually, but we both agree that, you know, it's a value to be kind and treat others with respect, and if they go to church, they're going to learn that, so that's good. But one of us believes that, you know, you should be kind and be respectful because the president of the church has encouraged us to do that, and the other one believes you shouldn't do it for that reason, you should do it because it's the right thing to do, right? And you're going to go to church and you're going to hear you should do it because the president of the church says we should do it. And so you're going to, and you might have the one spouse deal with that by when the children come home from church saying, you know, there are other reasons you might want to be kind as well, and kind of say that. But at some point, taking that kind of action could undermine the desires and wishes of the believing parent, right? So when you reach something that is a fundamental disconnect that really isn't bridged by going to common values or approaching nuance, how do you deal with a situation like that?
Did you have a response to his question, or were you going to ask a different question?
You know, as the questioning half of a marriage, I know our kind of implicit agreement was that I would never try to say anything to directly create problems, but kids can tell by what you don't say. And, you know, there are a lot of things that I emphasized according to my values, you know, humanitarian work and stuff like that. And there are a lot of, for instance, my son, I never said one word encouraging him to go on a mission until about 2 weeks before he finally says, you know, Dad, I got to know, is this a good idea or not? And I basically said, you know, it can be a good thing for you. And I really had to choke that one down. But my son made his own choice. He's an iron rod rock. And there's nothing that I could say or do that would make him a different person, really.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.